We mentioned that we want to build the standard model, the Lagrangian of the standard model, on the principles of gauge invariance and renormalizability. And we started discussing some of the issues that crop up when you introduce massive gauge bosons into your theory. Of course, it violates gauge invariance, but it also violates renormalizability. And so that's what we're going to show right now. The first step was just writing down what is the propagator for a massive vector boson. So we derived what that is at the end of last lecture. So in momentum space, we just had to shift the pole compared to the massless gauge boson. But the more important part was the fact that you have this extra polarization floating around. And so instead of having just the metric tensor, we have eta mu nu minus k mu k nu over ma squared. So it's really this term here that's going to cause a problem. When we want to think about renormalizability, we want to think about divergences appearing in various diagrams. And so we want to think about what the behavior of this propagator is when k becomes large. So of course, it would be dominated not in the same way as the photon by this term, but by this term. So for large k, I guess it would go like I, and then you have the k terms. Something like this. So it has a completely different behavior at large k compared to a massless gauge boson. OK, so this is going to spoil renormalizability of the theory. And I just want to remind you what happens in QED, where we just have a massless photon. So you have divergences in QED. For example, you can calculate self-energy diagrams, corrections to the electron propagator, or you can calculate vertex corrections like this. And these diagrams are divergent. And then you can absorb those divergences into redefining the parameters of your theory. So, so you would just renormalize the wave functions, the electric charge, and electron mass. But you can absorb all the divergences, no matter how complicated your diagram is, into a redefinition of these finite set of things. OK, so that's what we like about a renormalizable theory. So in massive QED, where we have this mass term for the gauge boson, doesn't work that way. We have new divergences that can appear in diagrams that we wouldn't necessarily expect based on QED. So I'll just do a quick example. Let's consider the four-point function. In a massive QED. So we want to consider it at one loop. So this is just a scattering process. We have two fermions in, two fermions out. So one of the diagrams is a box diagram. So this is supposed to be the massive gauge boson, like this. And I just want to think about the divergent parts of this diagram. If you calculated this in QED, it would be finite. There would be no divergence. So OK, so we have four gauge couplings here. So OK, I'll write it proportional to g to the fourth. Then we have a loop momentum. So I have d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. And then I just want to think about the factors of K that appear from the various propagators. And what I'm going to write down, of course, is going to be very schematic. I'm not actually going to compute anything. We have two fermion propagators. So those schematically go like 1 over K slash. And there's two of them, so I'll just write this squared. I'm not worrying, actually, about how any of the indices are contracted with one another. And then we have two gauge boson propagators. So the leading term goes like K mu, K nu over K squared. And then there's two of them, so I'll just schematically write squared here. Okay, and then I want to just think, you know, what is the leading divergence as I do this integral? So I'm going to imagine that I do this integral up to some momentum cutoff lambda, and I just want to ask, how does the final answer depend on lambda? So we're just going to keep the divergent terms, and lambda will be momentum cutoff. All right, so I have 1 over k squared. This whole thing is 1. And then I have d4k. So the whole thing looks like it's quadratically divergent. So it should go like g to the fourth lambda squared. This is not quite right, because of course I need to include other diagrams as well. So once I include another diagram, it will cancel the quadratic divergence. So here is the diagram I just drew. So let me just draw K as going through the loop here. But I need to also include just this other diagram. So K would be going like this, and then like this, and then back like that. Okay? So if I want to think about the divergences in these diagrams, the only real difference is that here K is going this direction, and here it's going that direction. Here K is going in the same direction, but here it's flipped. All right, so the propagator here, one of the propagators, will just flip sign between those two things, if I'm only interested in the leading divergent part. So this sign flip here cancels that leading quadratic divergence, but it still leaves something that's log divergent. Question?
In that integral, you have like a 1 over k slash squared, 1 over k squared n, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the measure is k cubed.
It should be d4k. Is that what you mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, got it. Thanks, sorry.
So here I just have 1 over k slash, and one of them just goes to minus 1 over k slash. Okay, so that will cancel off the quadratic divergent part. You don't have a linear divergent part due to symmetry, and so then the leading divergence will be a log divergence. And so that one will persist once you add these two diagrams together. So this is still log divergent. So the whole thing, let me just try to be a little more precise here. So here I'll have k slash plus m psi over k squared minus m psi squared. So I'm just writing down one of the fermion propagators. And in this one, it would just go to minus k slash. Or maybe I should write it like this. And then this one would be plus. OK. So the k slash part will not contribute because to the divergence, because it will cancel out. And then the other linear term, the term that would give you the linear divergence, would be the term from the other part of the propagator proportional to k slash. And so the thing that I'm left over with is, so I still have g to the fourth, m psi squared, and then a log divergence, like this. Okay, so I have this divergence. It doesn't go away if I actually compute these integrals. So it tells me that the four-point function has a divergence. I cannot absorb it into any other parameter of the theory. So if I want to renormalize the theory, I need to introduce a counter term into the Lagrangian that cancels this divergence. And in particular, I have a four-point function, four fermions. And so I need to introduce a four-fermion operator into the Lagrangian for my counter term. So I need a dimension 6 term in the Lagrangian. So that term is just C, some constant, and then a four fermion operator like this. Okay, so if I want to absorb this divergence, I need to introduce this term in the Lagrangian. And then by I can absorb that divergence just by renormalizing C. Okay, so C, of course, is a non-renormalizable coupling. So C has mass dimension minus 2. And so even though I started out with a theory in which all of the mass dimensions of all of the interactions in the Lagrangian are positive or 0, I must introduce higher dimensional operators in my theory to absorb divergences that appear at one loop. OK. So I must have a non-renormalizable theory. So then if we want to compute the matrix element for the scattering process, we should include the tree level contributions. Plus the loop contributions. But I also have to include the contribution from this counter term. Like this. Okay. So it's not possible to predict the magnitude of the scattering process from first principles based on the parameters of Lagrangian that I had before, because I have this new parameter. So I would need to fix that by doing an experiment and measuring scattering. That would allow me to determine this coupling. And then I would be able to compute scattering in terms of this coupling. But that's the story. Once you have a non-renormalizable theory, it's less predictive. Of course, that's not the end of the story here. We had an issue with this four-point function. But you can imagine that once you start computing higher point functions, you need to include more and more counter terms in your theory, and you have more and more higher dimensional operators. OK. So it's kind of a problem. We wanted a renormalizable theory. We know that massive gauge bosons exist, the W boson and the Z boson. So how do we write down a renormalizable theory that's consistent with these facts? Well, the answer, or the way around this issue, is through something called spontaneous symmetry breaking. So here's the story with this. What we just showed is that violating the gauge symmetry explicitly, and what I mean by this is at the Lagrangian level, Writing down explicit terms in your Lagrangian explicit parameters that violate the symmetry, this causes problems. However, the theory can be spontaneously broken. Or I should say the symmetry can be spontaneously broken. Even if the Lagrangian is symmetric. So the idea is we're going to start with a theory that does respect the symmetry, and we'll see that we're going to violate the symmetry at the end of the day in such a way that will avoid the problems that we just introduced. So I want to just start out by making just kind of a general argument about what it means to be, why a spontaneously broken symmetry is different than explicitly breaking a symmetry. And the basic idea is that the ground state of, so let me just start out by saying, OK, suppose we start with a theory that is invariant under a symmetry, such as a gauge symmetry. And the idea is that the ground state, where the symmetry is broken, may have a lower energy compared to a state where the symmetry is unbroken. And I guess the standard example of this is like a ferromagnet. Of course, you know, the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian is symmetric under rotations, but the ground state of the theory is where all the spins have lined up, spontaneously breaking rotational invariance. So the argument will be quite similar. Suppose we have some symmetry transformation U. So U is a symmetry transformation. That leaves the Hamiltonian H invariant. So if we have the Hamiltonian, we do this transformation. We just act on both sides with U. And it's invariant, so you get back the same Hamiltonian you started with. So this is what I mean by saying that the theory itself is symmetric under the symmetry. If we included explicit symmetry violation at the Hamiltonian level or the Lagrangian level, would not respect this. Okay, but suppose we do start with a theory like this. And let's say we have two states. So we'll have state A and state B. And in terms of creation operators, this will just be a creation operator for state A acting on the vacuum. And this will just be the creation operator for state B acting on the vacuum. Okay. And so I want to try to think about under what conditions are the two states, A and B, related to each other based on a symmetry, the symmetry transformation U. Okay, so let's start out with the following. If we want, here's what we want. Want A and B related by U, so that if I act with U on A, I get B. Okay? So I need to impose something about the how the symmetry transformation acts on the creation operators. So so we're going to first suppose the following, where we have the symmetry transformation acting on creation operator A just gives us creation operator B. But the question is this sufficient to guarantee that this holds? And so let's just start with this and see if we can prove that. So then we want to take the state A, act on it with the symmetry transformation, and see if we get B. So we have U acting on A. And I'll just insert U dagger U acting on the vacuum. So this part here will give me creation operator B. But then I'm still left with a U acting on the vacuum. If we make the further assumption that the vacuum is invariant under the symmetry transformation, so let's assume vacuum is invariant under U, then we have U acting on the vacuum gives us back the vacuum. And then I can write that this is just creation operator B acting on the vacuum, which is my state B. OK? But the reason I wanted to go through this exercise is just to highlight this implicit assumption here. If we want to relate two states to each other in this way, it has to be that the vacuum itself is invariant under the symmetry transformation. If it's not, then you can't relate the two states to one another. Okay, so the punchline is this is true only if the vacuum is invariant under U. Okay, if this is true, then we can prove very easily that states A and B have the same energy. So the energies of the two states are equal. So the energy of state A is just the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with respect to state A. And then I can just do, I can write A is, let's see, what do I want to do? So this is B. And then I have U dagger here, which is just U. And then U dagger, and then B, like this. And the Hamiltonian's invariant, and so this is just H. And so I just have the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with respect to state B, which is just the energy of state B. OK. So then the punchline here is if the ground state, the vacuum, preserves a symmetry, then the symmetry will be manifest. In the spectrum. Okay, so the ground state has to preserve the theory, and if that is true, and the two states are related by the symmetry transformation, then those states will be degenerate. On the other hand, if the ground state violates the symmetry, so the symmetry is no longer manifest. So we violated the symmetry. It's no longer manifest in the spectrum of states. However, there will be symmetry relations. That reflect kind of the hidden symmetry of the original Lagrangian, or the original theory. Okay. So this is what we're going to show, and this is going to be very important. The idea is that you're violating the symmetry because the vacuum state itself violates the symmetry. And so, but it's not the same thing as if you violate the symmetry by hand. All of the parameters that appear in the theory, remember that they ultimately came from a theory that was originally symmetric. Okay. So we'll see some examples now. So the plan now is to go through a series of successively more complicated Lagrangians or theories, where we make this idea explicit within a field theoretic framework. Ultimately, we want to build up to the Higgs sector, the scalar sector of the standard model. But first, we're going to start off simpler. So the first type of symmetry we're going to discuss is a discrete symmetry. So I'm just going to write down a theory where we can have a discrete symmetry that gets spontaneously broken. So I'm going to imagine that I have a theory with a real scalar field, phi, and a Z2 symmetry. That the theory is symmetric if I set phi to minus phi. So here's the Lagrangian. D mu phi squared, and then I need 1/2 minus 1/2 mu squared phi squared minus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. So the fact that we have the Z2 symmetry forbids us from having a cubic term. It also forbids a linear term. So we have no linear cubic terms. Now, let me start by just writing the Hamiltonian of the theory. This is Lagrangian. Let's write the Hamiltonian. So I just need to flip the signs of certain of these terms. I have 1/2 phi dot squared plus 1/2 the gradient of phi squared, and then plus what I'll call the potential for phi, where v of phi is 1/2 mu squared plus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. So this is the Hamiltonian density. So we want to think about the ground state. If we want the ground state, we want to try to minimize the Hamiltonian. So what should I take for phi to minimize the Hamiltonian? Well, of course, the first thing is that this kinetic part is positive. Yes?
Sorry, just I think it's mu squared phi squared.
Yeah, mu squared phi squared. Thank you. Yeah, perfect. So I want to think about minimizing the Hamiltonian. This term is always going to be positive. This term is always going to be positive. So if I want to minimize that term, I want to set those terms to 0. I just want to take phi to be a constant. So the energy is minimized if phi is a constant. So I want to set all these derivatives to be 0. Now, if I want to minimize the Hamiltonian, the only term that matters is the potential. And so I just need to worry about minimizing the potential. So we have two parameters in the potential, lambda and mu squared. And I just want to think of mu squared itself as a parameter of mass dimension 2 that could have either sign. It's not something, even though it's squared, that I'm going to necessarily take to be positive always. But lambda has to be positive. If lambda is not positive, the potential is unbounded from below, which means that the Hamiltonian is unbounded from below. But mu squared can have either sign. So we have two cases, one where mu squared is positive and one where it's negative. So this is going to be a plot of v of phi as a function of phi. In the case where mu squared is positive, both of those terms are positive, so it looks like quadratic function and then a quartic function, but it's always going to be increasing. Looks something like this. So if I want to minimize the potential, of course, the minimum is at 0. So the ground state is where phi is equal to 0. So the expectation value of phi with respect to the vacuum would be 0. All right, so that's case 1. Case 2 is where mu squared is negative. So in this case, I have a quadratic function that's turning down if phi is small. But then the quartic term will eventually win. And so it will look like this. And it's symmetric due to the Z2 symmetry. OK, so this is v as a function of phi. OK, So in this case, it's clear that the minimum of the potential is no longer at zero. Zero is a local maximum. But to minimize the Hamiltonian, I want to live either here or here, where phi is non-zero. So the minimum here is where phi is equal to some number, which I'll just call little v. And this number is not equal to 0. So this is v here, and this is minus v. Could have either one. So the expectation value phi with respect to the vacuum will be equal to v. OK. So how do I find out what v is? I just want to minimize the potential. So I just take the derivative of the potential at phi is equal to v, and that should be equal to 0 at the minimum. So this just gives me mu squared times v plus lambda v cubed. And I can solve this, and I get v is equal to plus or minus the square root of minus mu squared over lambda. And of course, mu squared itself is negative, so minus mu squared is a positive number. OK. So this tells me what v is. V is called the vacuum expectation value. This is the case where the symmetry is unbroken. If I'm at the minimum here, it's symmetric whether I'm going one direction or the other. So in this case, the symmetry is unbroken. This case, if I'm here, the potential looks different from one direction to the other, so I have broken symmetry. OK, so I want to now write down the theory in terms of physical states. Physical states are just small oscillations about the ground state. So I want to think of phi equal to v as the ground state. And I want to just expand around v. So what we want to do is define a shifted field. So I'll set my original field phi equal to v plus a shift, which I'll just call phi prime. And now I just want to write down the theory in terms of phi prime. So this will be for the broken case. So here's the Lagrangian. The derivative, when it acts on phi, it'll act on both of these two terms. But v is just a constant, and so I'll just pick up the derivative of phi prime. And now I have the potential at v plus phi prime. OK, so now I can expand out the potential. And I get, so I have, oh, there should be a 1 half here. Here's the kinetic part. Expand around out the potential, I have a 1 half mu squared v plus phi prime squared minus 1 quarter lambda v plus phi prime to the fourth. And I'll just expand this out some more. So we get minus mu squared phi prime minus mu squared phi prime squared. Then I have minus lambda v phi prime cubed. And then I have minus lambda over 4 phi prime to the fourth. OK, so this is what I get when I expand out the potential in terms of the shifted fields. First of all, in the original theory, we had a quadratic term and a cubic term, but there was no, we had a quadratic term and a quartic term, but there was no cubic term. Here we have a cubic term. So we had this original Z2 symmetry. We no longer have a Z2 symmetry for our new field. So the Z2 symmetry is broken for our shifted field phi prime. So if I just wrote down this Lagrangian and showed it to you, you would say there's no symmetry in the theory. I have terms that violate the symmetry. But you can see that not all of the parameters are independent from one another. And that's how the symmetry is remembered. So we have relations between the parameters. Are the remnant of the original symmetry. So let's just talk about the parameters. We have the mass of phi prime. So there's just a factor of 2. If I want to normalize the mass term, I need to have a 1/2 in front of there. So I need to introduce a factor of 2. It's just 2. And then minus m squared. Mu squared. And this is just equal to 2 times lambda times v squared. Okay? And so you can see that there is only a limited number of parameters that enter into the Lagrangian. I have 3 terms entering into the Lagrangian, or 3 couplings in general, for my quadratic term, cubic term, and quartic term. But I still only have 2 parameters. Just like I only had 2 free coupling constants in my original symmetric theory. So we only have 2 parameters. You can take them to be any combination you like. You could think of them as lambda and mu squared, or the mass and the vacuum expectation value. But in terms of those 2 parameters, you can define all 3 terms in the Lagrangian. So quadratic, it's OK. The 3 interactions in the Lagrangian are defined in terms of 2 parameters. OK, and that is how the symmetry is remembered. OK. So next, we'll do a slightly more complicated model. So we're still going to write down a scalar theory, but instead of having a discrete symmetry, we're going to have a global abelian symmetry. So we'll have a complex scalar phi, and the Lagrangian will be d mu phi d mu phi dagger plus mu squared phi dagger phi minus lambda phi dagger phi squared. Maybe this is better. Okay. So, first of all, Lagrangian is invariant under a symmetry, under a U1 transformation, where I just multiply phi by a face, e to the I alpha. Okay? And I'm going to assume that this mu squared is going to be positive. So we have spontaneous symmetry breaking. And I'll write down what the potential is. So it's just minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. Okay. So we want to find out what the ground state is. We just need to minimize the potential. I should sketch what the potential looks like. And then we'll also take the derivative. So the derivative is just dv by d phi. I get minus mu squared plus lambda phi dagger phi times phi dagger. And I want to set this equal to 0. Am I missing a factor of 2 somewhere? It might be. Oh, yeah, this should be a factor of 2 here. OK. So this is satisfied when the term in parentheses is equal to 0. So this tells me that the magnitude of this complex field should be the square root of mu squared over 2 lambda. And this is equal to my vacuum expectation value. But for convenience, I'm going to normalize it with an additional root 2. So I'll write this as v over root 2. That's just a convention. So I'll try to sketch the potential, v as a function of phi. And the scalar field, of course, has a real part and an imaginary part. And so I should draw two scalar directions here. This will be the real part of phi, and this will be the imaginary part of phi. So the minimum is where the magnitude is equal to this value, this constant, which defines a circle in the plane. Not at 0. So let me try to draw it like this. Kind of like this. OK, so the whole setup is supposed to look like the bottom of a wine bottle, in which the minimum is a circle that goes around like that. OK. So for the discrete case, we had just two degenerate minima for the Hamiltonian. Now we have a continuum of minima. So as an infinite number, of degenerate minima. All related by the symmetry transformation. multiplying by a phase just brings me around the minimum here. So let's write the following. My scalar field phi is just going to be a real plus an imaginary part, phi 1 and phi 2. And for convenience, I'll divide by root 2. And because we're free, based on the symmetry transformation, to go around the minimum, I can pick exactly where I want the minimum to be, just using this transformation. So, so we're free to assume only phi 1 gets a vacuum expectation value. Vacuum expectation value is often abbreviated just as VEV. So I'll just say VEV from now on. Only phi 1 can get a VEV because we're free from the symmetry transformation. So that tells me that the vacuum expectation value of phi 1 is equal to V over square root of 2, which is the square root of mu squared over lambda. And then the expectation value of phi 2 is equal to 0. So now I want to go through this same exercise of defining shifted fields and expanding around the VEV. Okay, so our shifted fields will be, So I'm just going to expand phi 1 around the VEV in terms of some other field phi 1 prime. And phi 2, I don't need to shift it because the VEV of phi 2 is 0. So now the Lagrangian is as follows. I have 1 half d mu phi 1 prime squared plus 1 half d mu phi 2 prime squared minus mu squared phi 1 prime squared minus lambda times v phi 1 prime. And then I have phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared minus lambda over 4 phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared squared. OK? So I just expanded it in terms of the different terms. So the argument looks very similar to the case of the discrete symmetry. Again, we have terms in the Lagrangian that you would not expect based on having a theory that has a certain symmetry. For example, we have terms that are cubic in the fields. Okay? So the new theory does not make manifest the symmetries of the original theory. But you can see that, again, there are symmetry relations which relate the different couplings to one another. We still have three interactions that are defined in terms of two parameters, and that's how the symmetry is remembered. We can also ask, what are the masses of our shifted fields? So the mass of phi 1 prime squared is just given by this term, so it's just 2 times mu squared. But you can also see that, well, there's no mass term for phi 2 prime. So it must be massless. And there's an easy way to understand why phi 2 is massless. We're defining these shifted fields around the vacuum. So just sketch the potential again. So here is the vacuum in which only phi 1 gets a VeV. In terms of the shifted fields, the phi 1 prime direction looks like this. So there's an energy cost to go to be displaced from the minimum. That's the mass term. But for phi 2, it's the direction like this, phi 2 prime. So in that direction, you're going around the minimum. There's no energy cost to go in that direction. So to travel, no energy cost to travel along the minimum. OK. So the fact that we started with a theory which had this global symmetry, we break it spontaneously, and we get a massless degree of freedom is a consequence of a general result known as Goldstone's theorem. So it states that for every symmetry that's broken, spontaneously, there is one massless degree of freedom. This is known as a Goldstone boson. For every generator, that is no longer a symmetry. So in the case of this abelian global symmetry, we just had a U1. There's only one generator, and we have one Goldstone boson appearing, one massless degree of freedom. So U1 at one generator. OK. I guess we're basically out of time. Tomorrow, we're going to keep continuing the discussion. We're going to ramp it up slightly and consider more complicated models and how spontaneous symmetry breaking works in those contexts.